Welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm Tim Mullaney with Home Healthcare News. Before we jump into my conversation with HomeWatch Caregivers CEO Julie Smith, I want to give a shout out to our podcast sponsor, Homecare Homebase, whose powerful cloud-based home health software streamlines virtually every aspect of your business. Spend less time on paperwork and more time delivering quality care to the patients who need you. Visit hchb.com to learn more. Since joining HomeWatch Caregivers in 2015, Julie Smith has led the company from being family-owned to being in private equity ownership through transactions that set industry records for their multiples. Today, Colorado-based HomeWatch Caregivers is leveraging the PE capital to expand its footprint, which includes more than 190 locations across 33 states and 6 international markets. The company is also bolstering its technology platform to drive care coordination and other efforts. Smith is bullish on Medicare Advantage, but also has concerns about how to better match up the franchise-based home care model with the needs of increasing care coordination with different types of payers and providers. Julie, welcome. It's wonderful to have you on the Disrupt podcast.
Good morning. Good morning, Tim. Thanks so much for taking time and having me join you this morning.
So to start our conversation, I just want to turn the clock back a little bit and ask about your background and how you kind of came into the home care space to begin with. So I think, am I correct that you studied business in college at the University of Denver?
I did. And so we're not going to turn the clock back too far. I'm not going to tell you how long ago it was, but I did do my undergraduate work at the University of Denver. And then I did my graduate work at Thunderbird, the Global School of International Management. And that was a few decades ago, but I was part of their International Executive Management Program.
Great. So I guess in that time period when you were studying business at both levels, undergrad and then in graduate school, what did you sort of envision for your career?
I truly did not know. I wanted to get into politics, but that was a far stretch for me at that time. And I think probably for most of us, probably even a bigger stretch now. But I knew business was it. And I knew that even at an early age, I wanted a multi-unit component. I certainly wanted an international component going to Thunderbird. I mean, just the lunchroom there was fabulous, like the United Nations. It was a fantastic international component to it. And in my life, I'm a fact-based, data-driven executive, but there always has to be a strong reason behind the brand, a strong mission behind the brand. And so HomeWatch Caregivers really checks all those boxes for me.
Interesting. But you didn't have a specific kind of healthcare orientation when you were, say, at Thunderbird?
I didn't. I wasn't organized enough. My undergraduate work, I played basketball, so I was very much a college athlete, and that was my focus. And I was more focused on play than I was on work. But once I realized I need to use my gray matter more than running up and down a basketball court, my thoughts really started to form around it. But I did have a passion for impacting people through business. And I think probably in today's podcast, we'll talk a little bit about that. But I've been very fortunate in my career to land up at organizations that make a big contribution.
Great. So yeah, let's start talking about that a little bit, the specific kind of career trajectory that you've had. So I think it's a pretty interesting, varied background, especially for someone now in home care. So can you just sort of talk us through your early career briefly, walk us through some of your early jobs? I think leading up till you ended up being a division president at Alta Colleges.
Sure. Just a quick snapshot. I actually started my career when I was 9 years old, believe it or not. I was working in a mailing room in Phoenix. I wanted to get my mom a Christmas present, but I didn't have any money at the age of 9, so I wandered and found this job making 75 cents an hour and ended up kind of cutting my teeth as a capitalist early on. But then I made my way more to traditional retail. And, you know, I worked for a company that was eventually acquired by the Sunglass Hut, one of those, you know, just you're inside the mall and you see those little stores that have sunglasses in it. There were about 3,500 units. But retail was fantastic for me. I think retail and food services are something that I wish everybody would take a part in early in their career. It really deepened my roots in customer service and process management. And it's a significant and healthy dose of humility, I believe, for those who are working in those industries. And it's an important, you know, being a part of those service sectors and being grounded in the service of others, I think it really helps people be more patient in our lives and a lot more understanding in their lives. So I started in retail, and then I had stints within technology, the home furnishings industry, and the international travel and tourism industry. And my early career was classic for Gen X. I'd stay for a few years, transfer technology, help organization build value, make contribution. But I always needed something in my youth that was about change and growth. And so I got that. And it was the basis sort of for an adaptability, if you will. Working in a broad variety of industries really helped me develop what I like to refer to as intellectual adaptability and bring all of that experience forward as I advanced in my career. And then Alta Colleges was proprietary education, so similar to the University of Phoenix, but smaller. And that's where I began managing the shared services. We had about 5,000 employees. So in addition to managing multiple on-ground and online educational institutions, I managed the shared services, human resources, purchasing, real estate for this. They had about 5,000 employees and 35 units across the country.
So curious, I think then, if I'm looking at your resume right, you went on to be in that sort of education vertical for a while, COO and an executive VP at the Princeton Review and group president in Lincoln Educational Services. So wondering if you can maybe speak to how you liked being in the world of education a little bit and any highlights from those years.
Yeah, I did. I loved it. I had a little over a decade in the education sector, and the Princeton Review is one of the great education brands. At the time, they were about a 30-year-old brand. And they provided college entrance test preparations to over 100,000 students in 14 countries at that time. And as the operational leader of the organization, I had an employee base of about 10,000 employees delivering services to students across that broad geography. And what it really did was it helped hone my focus on scalable systems and focusing in on building commercial value, because the Princeton Review was a publicly traded company, and that was my first time moving into that domain. You know, one of the unintentional consequences of standardized testing is that there's a built-in bias. So in many cases, the best students are not necessarily the best test takers, and I would be one of those folks. So the mission of this organization was to level the playing field and help students get into the colleges of their dreams. And as I mentioned to you before, you know, I always look for the mission and those biases against lower socioeconomic areas, individuals or women, for example. It's just built into the process. So it was a really important mission. And on the business perspective, we would provide test preparation services through our fixed locations in the United States, but also temporary locations such as high schools and churches. So if you think about the model of a regional airline system, you know, that scheduling and that loading and seat maximization of a regional airline carrier, that model kind of translates over to test preparation services in that when you're running in thousands of locations around the United States, you have to maximize those class loads and also have great systems and instructors in place. And so that's where I really, I think at that scale, that was a wonderful opportunity. And then I segued into Lincoln Educational Services. And Lincoln at the time was a 75-year-old brand. It was about $750 million, publicly traded education corporation and consolidator. And at Lincoln, again, I managed multiple academic institutions, but I also launched their regionally accredited online learning program. And that was just a wonderful opportunity. I had a nice 6-year career at Lincoln. It was a great, reputable brand. They provided strong education. And then the Obama administration brought in regulations, as you may know, that really cast a wave across the entire sector. And so my final 2 years at Lincoln were really about bringing them back to their roots, closing down online learnings, creating a smaller footprint, and helping that corporation position itself for being a vocational, trade-focused, nationally accredited institution. So those were two great opportunities that rounded out my education sector experience.
Great. So curious about then how you ended up making that leap into home care. And I think that was in 2015 that you joined HomeWatch Caregivers.
I was. And a recruiter found me. And interestingly enough, I'd never heard of the sector. I certainly knew about home health care, but like many people in society, I didn't know about home care. And my brother and I were taking care of our 82-year-old mother at that time, both of us living remotely. And we were really desperate for the services of home care. I didn't know that there were companies that could help with activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living, and she was falling, and we were anxious and didn't know about the sector and the caregivers could come in and help her age safely. So the recruiter introduced me to the family. That was a family ownership at that time. I learned more about the fundamentals of the industry, which I know you and I are going to get into. But this opportunity really hit square on with an important aspect of my life and the issues that so many of us are dealing with aging parents right now.
So can you sort of talk us through where the company was when you came on board? I think it was a new private equity owner was entering the picture for the first time. And so kind of talk through your decision to take that CEO job and what you were facing as your first priorities at that point. I think it was you came in as president in 2015 and then took on the CEO role in 2016. Is that right?
I did. If I could take you back to 2015, I think it'll be informative just for our conversation. The family had been in the business for 40 years, and Paul Stauber was really one of the founders of the industry in my mind. And when they asked me to join, they were not thinking about an exit. They were thinking about scaling, building scalable systems, and really moving the business to the next phase of growth. And so the founder had handed the business off to his daughter, Leanne Reynolds, and she'd done a fantastic job. And so I was the first person who joined in the leadership capacity outside of the family. But once I got in here and took a look at the hyper-competitive model and the capitalization that was going to be needed for us to really compete, and the fact that the founder was a little bit later in the stage of his career here, it really made a lot of sense to exit the family, because they were willing to invest. But as you know, Tim, investment brings risk. And it just didn't make a lot of sense. So we went through an exit and we set the record multiple for the industry, which is a wonderful piece of validation for the family. And I think a big, important recognition of how the type of brand equity that they have built up over the years. So really becoming CEO was the next logical step in my career here at HomeWatch Caregivers.
Wow. What was that multiple? Can you share that?
No, I can't share it with you, but I will tell you that even today, 1 year later, so we have actually sold twice in 1 year, if you can imagine it. The industry, first of all, the market's a little bit irrational right now, but our network performance has been outstanding. So our first private equity owner was PNC River Art Capital, and we're a part of the Authority Brands concept. And it really has been a great experience. And now we're owned by Apax Partners, which is the 14th largest private equity firm in the world. They own great consumer brands such as Cole Haan and Tommy Hilfiger. So we're very excited about this next wave of growth for us as an organization.
That's great. I think that's really interesting that to me, sitting here, that seems like such a momentous change for the company to go from being family owned for so many years and then to go through two private equity sales. Can you sort of talk about just on the ground I imagine you've been really managing a lot of change.
We have, and you're exactly right. It is probably one of the more significant transitions that I led, is to go from a 40-year-old family business to one owned by the 14th largest private equity firm in the world. But what I find helps is that you anchor into your organizational values and mission at that time. And we have been fortunate in that, you know, our values are the same values as our private equity owners. And as people ask me often, what is it like working for private equity? Well, not all private equity is created equal. So we have gotten folks who want to derive value for every constituent that touches our business, which is part of my focus and one of my key values. So we focus on clients, caregivers, franchise owners, referral sources, and well as our investors ourselves. So when you look at finding a private equity firm, when we dealt with change, all of our conversations have been about, number one, We have great franchise owners, and they were excited to see the family exit, which they will at some point. They were thrilled to see that the family did so well, because at some point they will sell, and they're trading on the same brand equity fundamentals, strong fundamentals. And so people have been very optimistic. And so now what the conversation changes to, Tim, is what does this mean to me? How is this going to benefit me in my local market? And so leading through that change has not only been about the values, but showing them point by point over the last year how their businesses have been benefited by the change in ownership and recapitalization. And then it doesn't hurt that our growth right now is outpacing the industry. So as a results-focused executive, you know, we don't do everything perfectly, but right now I think we're performing strong under our new ownership, and our franchise owners are a big reason why.
So I think maybe that's a good segue to talk about the growth trajectory for Home Watch Caregivers. Can you speak to how you're thinking about growing the footprint? Are there certain targets for a number of new franchise locations over some time horizon, or how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so I think about growth in different tranches. One of our key areas of investment is same-store growth, organic growth, and supporting our current base. And as I mentioned earlier, we are seeing strong performance there. I also think about growth in terms of new acquisition owners, new franchise owner acquisition, bringing new owners into the system. And what we saw in 2018 with two sales is that really this has been a year of change and investment. But what I'm expecting in 2019 is we'll probably see about 25 new franchise owners joining the network. And I think that that's probably going to bump up to 35 in 2020. But interestingly, we only have just over 1% of people who commit an inquiry to join our network actually are accepted to join the network. We have strong criteria for people joining. And so we're going to be looking for folks who are interested in growth, but also making a contribution in their communities. And then the third way that I think about growth is acquisition itself. And that's either through independents who have independently owned home care businesses and who are looking for opportunity to join the network and leverage those economies of scale and system scale benefits that come with franchising. And then also, where possible, internationally and domestically, a small franchisor where we don't have a lot of brand overlap, market overlap, things that would cause disruption with our current owners. So we really think about growth at those three investment levels. And, you know, knock on wood, we've been fortunate thus far to have strong growth.
Great. I guess before we move on too much past the sort of private equity issue, I want to maybe dig into that just a little bit more. I think you used the phrase that maybe the markets are a little irrational right now, and we've just seen so much private equity activity. Mm-hmm. And it seems notable to me that you would go through sort of these two sales, so back to back. So I guess I'm wondering if you can provide any more detail about what drove that quick transition for Home Watch Caregivers specifically, and or just in general, what you're observing out there about what is happening in the market, if it's a little irrational right now.
Sure. So at a high level, this is a perfect industry for private equity ownership, in my opinion. And there's only a couple of brands left that are not private equity owned. It's hyper-competitive. It's hyper-local. You really need strong capital base to be able to compete. You're competing not only for clients from referral sources, but you're also competing for caregivers, which I know we're going to touch on in a little bit. But for home care companies, we have to formalize our footing within the continuum of care. And that takes investment, that takes leverage. And so I do believe it's a perfect space for private equity, especially when you see those fundamentals of 10,000 people turning 65 years of age every single day. So it's very attractive for private equity. Beyond that, when you think about Home Watch Caregivers and the market itself, you know, the results are there. And so private equity, just like a franchise owner, or just like us as a franchisor, you know, you want to generate a return on your investment. And typically a private equity hold will be anywhere from 3 to 7 years. This was a shorter hold for us. But the results were there. Our owner was able to exit because there's just a lot of money in the marketplace right now. And private equity kind of going to that market is a little bit irrational. Private equity needs to invest. They need to find strong investment in strong sectors with strong executive officers that will eventually lead to their exit. So it is unusual to have a one-year hold, but it really makes sense in conjunction with the marketplace right now, the industry, and our results. But I won't mind it that Apex holds on to us for a few more years. It's a lot to go through due diligence twice in 1 year.
Great. Yeah, I can imagine. So I want to turn to technology now, which I think is really transforming home care. It's a big topic that we report on a lot, and I know that it's something that you've been focused on at Home Watch Caregivers. So wondering if you can just sort of speak generally about the types of technology that you're excited about and what Home Watch Caregivers is thinking of investing in and the kind of initiatives that you've been leading.
Happy to. So we invested in a proprietary technology base known as Care Plus in 2015 and 2016. And Care Plus gives us several advantages. One is we're able to track outcomes and demonstrate results using internationally recognized tools such as Lawton or GPCOP that we comported to home care. Now, many competitors demonstrate outcomes, Tim. That's nothing new. But what are those outcomes grounded and based upon? And one of the advantages of Care Plus is that we're using systems and measurement systems that are recognized by our referral sources. So when you're engaged in a conversation about ambulation, we can reference that our technology in that segment is based upon the Lawton principles, which we find really helps. Care Plus also allows families, clients, and caregivers to track their progress under our care. How are they progressing with ambulation, as I've mentioned, or with nutrition, with personal grooming? Are they consistently taking their medication? Care Plus is a technological answer to those questions and more. And Care Plus will also allow us for systems interoperability, which is key when you think about working within the healthcare continuum. Our system needs to be able to communicate with home healthcare, hospice, other health providers out there. And then lastly, Care Plus houses proprietary tools around data and analytics that support our franchise owners with operational, clinical, and financial metrics, because they'll be with us for 10 or 20 years as a brand, but businesses go through peaks and valleys, and the system itself gives them visibility into that those valleys. And Tim, I said lastly, but I do have one more thing to add. Care Plus is also a matching system to make sure that caregivers, for example, have the skills to handle clients with dementia. Are we matching caregivers who have skills in dementia with clients who have dementia? And also, it's a compliance-oriented brand standards tracking system. So from our perspective, from an investment level, Care Plus was a huge focus. It's something that we leverage, that we point to as differentiation in our marketplace. And then on the technology conversation, it also spins out great partnerships that help solve for, you know, care coordination that we can speak of a little bit later in our podcast.
Yeah, well, maybe now's a good time to talk about care coordination, because I think another topic that I'm eager to talk about is Medicare Advantage. And I think that obviously care coordination and having the technology in place to capture data and communicate across the continuum are all sorts of parts of this discussion. So maybe that tees up this question well about Medicare Advantage. And I think you were one of the first home care CEOs I spoke to last April after CMS announced that Medicare Advantage would be allowed to cover non-skilled in-home care for the first time starting in 2019. And even that, I think, very first day that announcement came out, you were bullish on the opportunity. So I'm just curious, what do you make of where we are today? Have you been speaking with MA plans? Can you speak at all about how you kind of see the opportunity playing out?
Sure. It's an exciting time, and I am still bullish. That was a wonderful conversation that you and I had, and it was and still is an important policy recognition of home care. You may know that I spoke at your summit in Chicago alongside the executives of Amedisys and Humana, and all of us were speaking about how instrumental home care has been but is becoming in the importance of reducing hospital readmits, and just how important supporting family members, keeping them safe in the home. We're the eyes and the ears of the home when home health care and family members are not there. And reducing those hospital readmits is really one of the great opportunities around home care. So I felt, and I still feel, that the Medicare Advantage pivot, if you will, is a big policy recognition of this. And I'm very excited about what it's going to bring to our sector. As you know, there's just a little bit of guidance trickling out. Mm-hmm. And we're still waiting to hear from everybody. Anthem, I think, was one of the first out, and they've shared some of the services that will be covered, but we're still waiting on rates, for example. But I will say, kind of as a word of pause, I was disheartened to hear that one provider may require folks in our sector to be Medicare certified. And even though CMS is not requiring that, I was really disheartened to hear that that may come along with one of the providers. So I would caution and hope that everybody recognizes that home care is somewhat unencumbered by deep regulatory requirements. And let's keep us there. It's very important for our innovation, for us to be adaptable to the needs of family members and to weave in alongside home care, great home care partners or hospice partners. And so my hope is that this will not become, that there will be limitations that keep most home care players out there from joining. But, you know, when we talk about this is the right direction, and I think a couple of years from now, we will see home care really having stronger footing within the continuum. And I expect as rates roll out, it's going to bring dramatic changes to our sector, but important changes to our sector, Tim. So I'm still quite bullish on the opportunity. And as a network, we're very excited and very well prepared to participate.
Great. So staffing is another topic that sort of a must that we have to talk about, because it's the number one concern in the industry right now. We hear from people again and again. So wondering, how is Home Watch Caregivers approaching recruitment and retention? There's tight labor markets, rising wages, caregiver shortage, all of these challenges that seem insurmountable to some extent. So just curious how you're sort of approaching it.
Well, you're exactly right. The demographics just don't work, and it does at times seem insurmountable. But I think about caregivers as among the more unsung heroes in our culture. You know, they work day in and day out helping veterans and children with disabilities and seniors to stay in their homes, and for seniors specifically to age with dignity. And our industry has not always treated caregivers as the great asset that they are, but here at Home Watch Caregivers, they are placed on a significant level of priority, not only because of the demographics that you mentioned, but it was deeply rooted in the founding of the organization 40 years ago. And for me as the chief executive officer, one of the things I'm most excited about is that we have a rare opportunity to impact a broad demographic of society. And many, if not most, of the caregivers in this country are living on wages just above minimum wage, or they're single moms, and they're working at multiple agencies just to try and support their families. So for us, we feel that a responsibility to really improve the level and quality of life of our caregivers, which we know will transfer into the quality of life to our clients, which we know will transfer into more revenue and more business coming to our brand, is actually a strategic imperative. So we developed a program known as Care to Stay, which focuses in on making us an employer of choice, the brand of choice for caregivers. And it's not just enough to have competitive wages. It's not just enough to have competitive benefits, or to make sure that you create a compelling working environment. What we focus in on is continuity of pay. Caregivers just like you, Tim, need to be able to work at one location and be sure that they provide for their family. But in our model, the home care model itself, that's a little bit difficult to do. So that's a big focus of ours. And we also are very careful about the professional development and training of our caregivers to make sure that they're safe when they go into a client. And what we're finding is that translates into a very strong retention rate for our organization. So you're right. It is got people worried, and I think it should be a key area of focus. But for me, that's about opportunity. And I love how we've thrown ourselves behind really focusing in on improving the quality of life for our caregivers, because at the end of the day, our owners, our investment, our investors, our franchise owners know that it's good policy, but it's also a good practice in terms of growth and profitable growth for a home care franchise network.
Great. So as we sort of wind down our conversation, one question that I like to ask everyone is just what's keeping you up at night from a business perspective? We were just talking about staffing, and that's a popular answer. I'm wondering, is it staffing for you or is something else?
No, because I feel like we're making progress there. I never take it lightly. But one of the things, I think a couple of things keep me up. One is that franchising is perfectly suited for home care. You'll see most of the big players out there in the market is really heavily, got heavy footprints by franchisors. But franchising brings independent business owners. And so as a brand, we want to anchor into what makes us so effective, which is our franchise owners, but also continue to become a preferred home care provider to referral sources. And these two things, these two forces meeting together, don't always align. And an example is those in the home health space, you know, they're required to demonstrate the actuarial value of an initiative in order to advance that. Well, it's very difficult to demonstrate the actuarial value of some of the services that pure private duty home care provides. So how, as we advance the partnership, how do we handle that juxtaposition of what makes home health or hospice so successful in home care? And then I think the second thing that keeps me up at night is solving for care coordination. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but our technology, Care Plus, gives us the opportunity to work with innovative partners such as Prepared Health. And they're working on a regional level to utilize the mass amount of data that we collect to coordinate care with hospital systems and hospice. And they've used technology to help solve for that problem. So eventually, it's going to have a technology solution. And so that's another thing that keeps me up awake, because either you have a chair when the music stops or you don't in this sector. And we want to position ourselves as the preferred provider in the home care sector.
That's interesting. I guess on the flip side, are there business opportunities that seem most exciting to you?
Yes. I mean, the industry itself is extraordinarily exciting. Acquisition to fill in our footprint and these innovative partnerships that we've got with Prepared Health as well as with Lyft, those for me positions this very old brand in a relatively mature sector as a disruptor. And I know that's kind of strange. You know, franchising home care can come across as a little bit stodgy, if you will. And when you think about disruptors, HomeWatch Caregivers doesn't jump to mind, something like Uber will. But one of the biggest opportunities for me is how to position home care, HomeWatch Caregivers, as a disruptor. And that's what we've really been focused in on, is leveraging all of our tools and resources to shake up this industry a little bit, break up some of the bureaucracy, and help strengthen our competitive positioning within the industry.
Got it. So one thing I wanted to follow up on was early on, you mentioned that you thought of maybe going into politics back when you were in business school or undergrad. And I'm curious if you still consider yourself, are you tied into politics? And I think it's come up a couple times in the conversation how home care historically has been outside of the kind of regulatory regime of Washington, but to some extent that might be changing with Medicare Advantage, for instance. Can you sort of speak to the need for home care to have a voice on the Hill, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's critical. And I sit on the board of the Home Care Association of America, and this is a great body. $8 out of every $10 that comes into that organization goes towards legislative activity. And as a board member, I'm excited to work on policy recognition where we can. And there's just so much activity. I think the number is probably 30 now states in the U.S. that have license requirements for home care. I'm a big believer in smart, thoughtful regulation at the state level from home care, because it protects, it's a client and caregiver safety issue for me. And I think the gray market is not healthy for anyone. I don't think it provides the type of protections that it does. So something that is not overly encumbering, we would like to see in every state across the U.S. And, you know, to your broader question, by not participating in the legislative activities, by not participating, you know, tomorrow's a big day, it's voting day. By not participating, you actually are participating by abdicating your voice. And I believe it's a responsibility of all of us to be active citizens. But as an executive of a home care company, by participating, we're defining the industry rather than allowing it to define us. And that's something I'm quite committed to.
Yeah, you brought up tomorrow's election day. So the elections will have passed by the time people are listening to this. But I guess curious if you are concerned about any outcomes, maybe at the federal level specifically. We're thinking about the House flipping, maybe not. For home care specifically, do you think any one outcome is preferable to another, or do you have concerns or hopes?
No, not, you know, in my capacity, I consider home care to be a nonpartisan issue. What I want is continued policy that is smart, that is thoughtful, and I know that's challenging right now, but that helps people age at home. It's the best economic opportunity for citizens. It's the best financial opportunity for the home health care system, is to have people aging healthily, safely at home. So whether it's Republican or Democrat, I am up for thoughtful policy activity that continues to strengthen and formalize the home care sector, because as people will see, as those baby boomers continue to push into retirement, it is going to become more and more important. So the more thoughtful systems and policies and processes and procedures we have around this sector, the better it's going to be for society.
Great. And then I guess one other follow-up early on, you mentioned you played basketball in college. I didn't realize that. Do you still, I guess the broad question is, what do you do to sort of unwind and get some relief from the stresses of being a CEO? And I guess specifically, I'm wondering if you're still athletic.
I do. So I'm a little bit too old now to run up and down a basketball court, unfortunately, but I live in the great state of Colorado, so hiking is fabulous. And, you know, keeping ourselves as a CEO, focusing on our personal wellness and exercise and spiritual practice and family and friends, having a really healthy personal life, and part of that is being active, is still a commitment I've carried forward since I was a college athlete. So it was a long time ago, but it was a great part of my career, and I was fortunate to have been able to do it because my family lived below the poverty level, and so I would not have been able to go to college if it weren't for a college athletic scholarship.
Wow, great. So I guess just the last question is, the podcast is called Disrupt. So wondering how you define disruption in a business sense, and whether you...
Well, I do. And I touched on this a little bit earlier. It's hard to imagine a 40-year-old home care franchisor as a disruptor. I mean, when I use the term around here, even my team meets me with a little bit of giggles. But the fact of the matter is that we have some great disruptors come into our sector, as you know. And these were terrific models, but they all came face-to-face with the fact that we are a hyper-local industry. Local caregivers, local clients, local referral source relationships, and person-directed care is the focus of the sector. So those models, each of them had to come in and change direction. But what we did strategically is we watched the best of what they brought. And each of them brought a lot of great stuff, particularly in the technology sector. So we are using CarePlus as a disruptor. When you've got a home care company that has a system that's grounded in person-directed care, that's grounded in internationally recognized measurement systems, such as the Lawton or GPCOG, and you're able to facilitate systems interoperability, strategic partnerships that help solve care coordination, what we'll find is with the focus and the values of the organization, you end up being a disruptor at the end of the day, even though you're not trying to do so. So our focus on caregivers, our focus on technology and on the clients themselves, I think, Tim, will inherently make us a disruptor. And I'm interested in talking to you 5 years from now when we look back and see if what I'm guessing will happen actually did happen.
Well, we're interested in hearing from you along the way.
My pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
Thanks so much for taking the time to chat today. This was really great.